For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
This time in Jesus' life when he's ministering up in the northern part of Israel. And we've been in this section of Luke for several weeks. We saw that he's out there. He's healing people. He's doing miracles. He's teaching people. He's gathering disciples. Last week, we saw that Jesus was going to the last people in the world that they expected him to go to, the rejects of society, the sinners of society. And we saw that he's starting to draw some fire from the religious elite of that day. A group known as the Pharisees and the scribes and others as well, they had heard what Jesus was doing. He seemed unpredictable. He did not seem like he was the kind of guy they could control, like he was following their rules. And last week we saw he had two clashes with them. In Luke chapter 5, the first one we saw, he heals this guy and claims to forgive his sins. And they're asking this question here. The Pharisees, they're like, who does he think he is? That's blasphemy. Only God can forgive sins. And Jesus is like, yeah, that's right. Then he goes and he's partying with the most despicable sinners in society. And they say, why do you eat and drink with such scum? You couldn't have picked lower life people, more unclean, sinful people than these people right here. And Jesus is like, well, doctors don't go to healthy people, right? They go to sick people. That's who I came to call. Not the so-called righteous like you guys, but I came to the sick, the people that actually think they need a cure. And so tonight what we're going to see is three more episodes like this, three more of these clashes. And this first one comes right on the heels, and it picks up right with this concept of eating and drinking. It comes right on the heels of Matthew's party. It says, and they, and the context here seems to be the scribes and Pharisees, said to Jesus, you know, John the Baptist's disciples, they fast and pray regularly. And so do the disciples of the Pharisees. On the other hand, you guys, your disciples are always eating and drinking. Eating and drinking with sinners, eating and drinking in general. It seemed like they're having a little too much fun. What are they criticizing him for here? Well, the heart of this issue right here, this Jesus, what he's doing here is he's breaking their rules very intentionally. He's trying to prove a point that their rules are wrong and that they are wrong and that they need to get on board with the new thing that he's bringing, with a whole new way of life that we're going to see even more about next week. And the issue here really that he's violating in this first section here at the end of Luke 5 is their fasting rules. That's what he's going to spar with them on. The fasting rules. You know, fasting is where you don't eat for some amount of time. And, you know, it's the contrast between the fasting of the Pharisees and even John the Baptist's disciples, apparently, and the eating and drinking of Jesus' disciples. There's seeming neglect of the fasting rules. You know, in the Old Testament, fasting does show up there. There is one fast commanded, one day per year. That was on a day known as the Day of Atonement. It was a very special day where people were supposed to mourn for the sins of the entire nation. They were not supposed to eat anything on that day as a sign of sadness and grief. And there was a special sacrifice that God prescribed to be offered on that day that would, basically a sacrifice that would be offered on behalf of all the sins of all the people. So there's only one commanded one day per year. There are examples in the Old Testament where people are really sad and they don't eat. A lot of times because somebody died. You know, part of it might be the amount of work that it took to prepare a meal. And the happiness was often associated with eating. But, you know, they couldn't just pop something in the microwave. I mean, it was a lengthy procedure to prepare a meal. There are times, too, where people seem to be so into their prayer, and some of these prayers, people are sad about the sins of either of themselves or really of the people as a whole. You know, we saw in Esther a request for prayer and fasting from her as well. And so you do see some of this in the Old Testament where people voluntarily will do this. There's a handful of cases. But what you see in the Old Testament as well is that people were fasting as some sort of religious work, as some sort of like, this is for the really hardcore people, people that are really spiritually serious. And it was kind of a show. People would make a big deal out of how much they were suffering as they fasted for God. And they would complain, and they'd made sure people knew that they were fasting. They were not eating. They were depriving themselves out of some sort of piety or religiosity. And God would look at these people whose hearts were so far from God, not spiritual at all, not loving to anyone at all, and yet they're going through these religious works. And God says, I hate that. Isaiah 58, he says, we fasted before you, they say. Why aren't you impressed, God? We've been very hard on ourselves, and you don't even notice it. Can't you see I'm suffering here? I'll tell you why I respond, says God. It's because you're fasting to please yourselves. It's like you get something out of it. You feel like you're a spiritual person or something when you deprive yourself. So much of religion is about depriving yourself and thinking that's what God wants. Not true. He says, even while you fast, then you keep oppressing your workers, you rich. You humble yourselves. You go through the motions of penance, bowing your heads like reeds bending in the wind. He's like, you look like flimsy reeds in a windstorm. You're like, whoa. You dress in burlap. You cover yourselves with ashes, a sign of grief. Is this what you call fasting? Yeah, notice it's going through the motions of sorrow when they're not sorry at all. They haven't changed anything about the way that they live. Their hearts are as cold as ever toward God. You know, on the outside, they've got clothes that kind of look like they're sad, but their hearts are hard as a rock, and they will not listen to God, and they will not change, and they're as selfish as ever and oppressing the poor as much as ever. Remember what Jesus said? He said, I've come to preach the good news to the poor. I've come to release the captives. And he says, this is what you call fasting. I'll tell you the kind of fast I want. Free those who are wrongly imprisoned. Lighten the burden of those who work for you. Let the oppressed go free. Remove the chains that bind people. The very things Jesus said he was going to do. Share your food with the hungry. Give shelter to the homeless. And they're sitting there and they're like, I'd rather just skip breakfast. I'm not too interested in this kind of a fast. It's not even a fast. You know, there's nothing about not eating food on there. And God's like, I know. I don't really care, okay? What I want is this. And any sort of outward show of piety that doesn't include the inward heart change, not only is God not interested in that, God is disgusted by that. God hates it. He doesn't want anything to do with it. He hates hypocrisy. He hates that they honor me with their lips, but their hearts are far from me, God says. He says, get out of here. Get out of my face with that sort of nonsense, that sort of lies and hypocrisy. And so God is not happy with hypocritical fasting. Then we come into the New Testament, and we see, you can see right in the pages of the New Testament, plus a lot of extra biblical Jewish literature, they had added so many fasts into their annual and even weekly schedule. The Pharisees, we're going to see, even in the Gospel of Luke, they're so proud. This Pharisee is so proud. He says, I fast twice a week. They fasted on Mondays and Thursdays. And it's a sign of self-righteousness. He's so proud of this. He's just in so much pain for God. God must be so pleased with me, with these works I'm doing for him. You know, the rabbis taught, according to Kittel, it forgives sins. It heals diseases. It drives out evil spirits. It has power even to the throne of God. There was so much merit in fasting. And this is what man-made religion often loads up on. Self-denial, self-deprivation, and then that's going to get me something from God. It's like my works force God to give me something, and just God must be so lucky to have somebody like me. Well, then you look in the New Testament, and you see it's almost completely absent. You see it twice after the death of Christ. In both cases, it is linked to prayer and choosing of leaders, actually. But it's not about mourning or grief or sorrow or anything like that. And then you look at Jesus and his disciples, and they just look like they are having too much fun. They're not following any of the Pharisees' rules. And they're like, look, you know, we deprive ourselves and fast. I don't know if you've heard, but we fast twice a week. John the Baptist, his disciples fasted. And then you guys don't look like you're suffering enough. You look like you're enjoying this. Following God is not supposed to be fun. It's supposed to be painful. Like us, we're in pain. And fasting and depriving ourselves. This must be what God wants. And it just feels so meritorious. Painful. Deprived. Why can't you be more like us? And Jesus says, no. He says, did wedding guests fast while celebrating with the groom? Of course not. Jesus is like, look, the bridegroom is here. That was one of the images of Messiah, a bridegroom. In fact, that the end of the Bible actually ends with a wedding where Christ is united with his people, the church. He's the groom. We're the bride. And he says, when they're partying with the groom, they're not going to fast. No. Someday the groom will be taken away from them. Then they will fast. And there will be a couple days of sorrow here between the death and the resurrection of Christ. But after that, the sorrow is gone again. It's party time. It's joy. It's rejoicing. And so Jesus is like, man, you know, what wedding do you go to? I mean, their weddings lasted a week or more of partying and festivities and celebration. He's like, how depressing would that be? You walk into your wedding and the bride's walking down the aisle and everybody's just like, oh no. They got sackcloth on, ashes, they're moaning, they're wailing. That's not a wedding. Nobody wants a wedding like that. Jesus doesn't either. He says, no, it's party time. We're enjoying this awesome time that we've been looking forward to for millennia, when God is going to send a Savior, and now he's here, and you guys want to end the party? He says, look, no one tears a piece of cloth from a new garment and uses it to patch an old garment. For then the new garment would be ruined, and the new patch wouldn't even match the old garment. All right, so basically, you know, they you'd have a garment that had already shrunk. And what he's saying is, why would you take a new thing? Why would you rip something out of it and try to use that to patch the old thing? You know, eventually that new patch, that's going to shrink. And that new thing is, the new garment's stronger than the old thing. And it's just going to rip the seams. You know, it's going to rip the old thing. It's going to make an even bigger hole. He says, no, you've got to throw the old thing out. You know how hard it is to throw out an old, comfy pair of jeans. There comes a point, though, where it's just like, look, it's unpatchable at this point. These things are falling apart. Stop trying to reform the old pair of jeans. And, you know, Jesus is like, look, I'm bringing a new pair of jeans, okay? Put these on. The old thing, this linkage to the old. And contrast that with the new thing. What a waste this would be of the new thing, and how foolish it is. What a foolish and forlorn project to try to reform the old thing when he's bringing a whole new thing. He says, I'll give you another illustration. He says, nobody puts new wine into old wineskins. The new wine would burst the wineskins, spilling the wine and ruining the skins. Again, you see this real contrast between the new and the old, the new and the old, the new and the old. And the incompatibility of the two. You know, the way they did wine back then, they didn't have wine bottles. They would make their new wine, and then they would get a fresh wineskin. You know, it was a lot of times it was like the neck of a goat or something like that, where they would, you know, obviously clean it out. They'd scrape the hair off and stuff, wash it up. They would tie off the end, and then they'd make new wine. They'd pour it into there, and then they would tie the top off. And then they would let it sit. And as that wine fermented and released gases, the goat skin would expand. And where it started out nice and stretchy, it would expand to a point where it was pretty hard and brittle. But it would hold the wine. And you could drink the wine out of there. Now, you know, let's say you're trying to save money. You're like, well, I just killed this bag of wine here, this skin full of wine. And I got some new wine. I'll just take the new one. I got another batch. I'll just pour it into that old wine skin. Wouldn't work. The old one was already hard and brittle. It would try to do that same expansion process. It would break, it would burst, it would spill the wine, and it would ruin the skins. Again, he says, new wine must be stored in new wineskins, and what a waste it would be to take the old thing and to try to put the new thing into it. Again, the incompatibility, the uselessness, the need to discard the old thing and get on board with the new thing. That's what Jesus is saying in response to their critiques here. What a waste that would be. And then he says this strange thing. He says, you know, no one who drinks the old wine seems to want the new wine. You ever notice that? What is he saying here? The old wine is just fine, they say. The old wine is just fine. And, you know, what Jesus is saying is that he came to bring something totally new. Not to patch up the old way, not to reform the old way. God said, I'm going to make a new covenant, a new way of relating to you someday. And it's going to be completely different than the old one. In fact, it's going to render the old thing obsolete. It's obviously connected to the old thing, predicted by the old thing. There's continuity with it, and yet it's so completely new that he can call it a new covenant. He's not just reforming the old way. And clinging to the old way kept them from getting on board with the new thing that God was doing. You see that? They just can't take that Jesus is coming. He's breaking all their rules. He's not fitting into their preconceived notions. And Jesus is saying, I'm bringing something new. It's different than the old. It doesn't fit with the old. And you got to break with the old. And what they were saying is, we're pretty fine with the old way. They were pretty resistant, super resistant. In fact, so resistant that they're going to be ready to kill Jesus by the end of this book. You know, part of it is that they had power under the old way. They had so much invested in the old way. They had so many good works, so many rituals they had performed, so much merit that they thought they had stockpiled before God. And here Jesus comes along saying, yeah, actually, you don't. Your works can never be good enough. It's only those who admit they're sick that can come to the doctor and get healed. It's only those who open up the empty hands of faith that can be filled up with the forgiveness of God. And it's arrogant to claim that my good works make me good enough for God. And that's why Jesus had to die, is because he was living the perfect life we should have lived. He offered himself up as a sacrifice in our place, much like that big sacrifice on the Day of Atonement, where one sacrifice would cover the sins of all the people. And Jesus said, anyone who asks for forgiveness from me can receive it. But only those who ask, only those who lay aside their own self-righteousness and get down on their knees and say, woe to me, for I'm a sinful person. I need your forgiveness. That was keeping them. The old way was keeping them from getting on board with the new. And this does apply to us today as well. Some of us here, what's keeping you from coming to Christ is you kind of feel like, well, the old way is good enough. The way I've been living my life up until now. Some of us here have invested a lot of energy in religious rituals and in good works. And you don't like the notion that Jesus brought, that that's not good enough, that there's got to be something else. That God's standard is perfection. And that old way is keeping you from coming to Christ. And this is why the older you get, the harder it becomes to come to Christ. Because you've got so much invested in the old that it's hard to admit I was wrong. And the longer you say no to God, and the longer you refuse to admit that you're wrong, the harder and harder it's going to be to see the light, and your heart's going to become hardened, and your eyes are going to get clouded over. You might even get to the point where you can't even hear him anymore. Now is the day of salvation. Now is the time to respond, if you can hear his voice. And so it keeps people from coming to Christ. It also can keep people from following God once they're Christians. You know, Christians are really notorious for being inflexible, unchangeable, and clinging to the old ways. I mean, imagine you stumble upon a building with stained glass everywhere. You know you're in a church, right? Because nobody else uses stained glass. stained glass, that was cool like centuries ago. 1500s. Not cool anymore. Christians are the only ones using it. There's a lot of Christians that still sing hymns, songs that were written hundreds of years ago. They're full of these and thous. They read Bible translations from 1607. I mean, it's like Shakespeare, you know? This is older English. I guess it's not old English, technically. For all you English majors, okay? But it's sure older than we got today. Dost thou not thinketh? You look at the garb that Christian leaders, they stand up in front with these weird-looking flowing robes on. Where else does a dude wear a robe? It's clinging to the old ways, and then people, they come into church and they're like, this is so strange. I have to abandon everything I know from my culture. And Jesus, you know, Jesus, what God wants is he wants us to be able to keep our structures. You know, God, the wine is the thing that God is doing. And these skins could be an analogy for the different structures. The way we do church, the outward forms, and we need to be flexible on those. We need to be willing to change on those. You know, in this church, you know, we have been guilty of this in the past. You know, there were the first 20 or so years of Xenos' existence, we did not own a building. They rented a warehouse to meet in, and it was creating more and more problems. And the leaders of the church went to the congregation, and they were like, look, we need to raise money to build a church building for all these reasons. And people were like, oh, I can't believe this. We're abandoning everything that makes us who we are. We've really sold out. Because they wanted to get a building that we owned. And there was just an uproar. People just couldn't. They had kind of locked into one way, one skin, and they couldn't get on board with times are changing and our skins need to change too. I remember when College CT there was only one meeting per week. It was a much smaller facility, and we didn't have the space to expand into. And so the leadership of our college group came to us, and they were like, look, I know that right now all home churches are on Monday and everybody goes to CT on Thursday, but we're going to try this thing where half of our groups have home church on Thursday and have CT on Monday. And I was like, that is so weird. I mean, CT, that's a Thursday thing. And home church, that's what you do on Mondays. It was blowing my mind. I just thought, I'll never adjust to this. So then we switch. And then when I started teaching CT, it was like, our home church has to rotate between Monday and Thursday. And I was like, that's going to be so weird to have CT on Thursday and home church on Monday. When just a few years earlier, that was all I knew, and it was weird to do the opposite. I do feel like our fellowship, okay? And especially, I think student ministries tend to be more into flexibility, willingness to change. And I really appreciate that. I hope we keep that spirit, and I hope we always remain a flexible group where we can respond and get on board with new structures, new ways. I mean, our leadership in our church, we try to be real rigorous about this every year. In fact, the reason I wasn't here last week is because we have this annual retreat with our leaders where we go away and we just think through the entire church from top to bottom, everything we're trying to do, how effective is it, and we think through, does any of this need to be discontinued, which is really hard to discontinue something. Does any of this, do we need to start something new? Do we need to change things? It's hard to not get locked into a sort of paradigmatic thinking. What happens is you get inflexible, you get brittle, and God's pouring the wine and it's spilling out everywhere. You're not holding it. It's a waste. And so we need to resist this whole, we've always done it this way and we can't change. We need to be flexible. We need to be willing to follow God's Spirit when He moves. And so this is the first clash Jesus has is over fasting and not following their fasting rules. There's two more, both related to the Sabbath. It says, one Sabbath day, as Jesus was walking through some grain fields, his disciples broke off heads of grain, rubbed the husks in their hands, and ate the grain. All right. And they said, why are you breaking the law? But some Pharisees said, why are you breaking the law by harvesting grain on the Sabbath? Okay, so what were the disciples doing? Okay, the Sabbath, God had given them one day per week called the Sabbath. Seventh. Sabbath means seven. And on that day, he was like, look, just take the day off. You guys get the day off. Go home. Enjoy your families. Hang out with your neighbors. Give all the employees the day off. The animals get the day off on the Sabbath day. You guys got to rest. You got to create some margin in your lives. You got to block out time where you can, you know, they would usually gather to read the word and to have like a little service. And he's like, look, you guys just take a vacation day. Take the day off. And then there wasn't just Sabbath days, which is what this is talking about. He also implemented Sabbath years. And a Sabbath year, you weren't, instead of going out and planting crops again like you do every year, he says, look, this year, don't plant anything. Take the year off from planting stuff. And then enough stuff's going to grow. You dropped enough seed last year when you harvest. Stuff will grow. Go out, eat that. Let other poor people come in. Let them take as much as they want. And just have a year off. You know, they couldn't really like schedule like a 3-week vacation back then because the whole harvest farming thing didn't really work with that. So God would just say every seventh year, I just want you to take the year off from planting and all that stuff. Turns out that's a lot better for the ground too. Farmers intentionally will leave certain fields off periodically, crop rotation, but they didn't know that. But God, part of what God is telling them is you need to trust me and you need to take a break. Because you guys are not infinite like me. You're not, you run out, you get tired, and you need to rest. And so that was the original intention. It was supposed to be something to be enjoyed, something really good. And then what they were doing when they were going to the fields and they were just kind of picking grain, heads of grain, kind of rubbing, they kind of had to rub the outer part off and then they could eat the inside part. They were allowed to do that. That was a provision that God made for the poorer people in society. He said, look, you can just, he said, for one, you're not supposed to harvest the corners of your fields. Let the poor people get that stuff. And also, if somebody's walking through your field, just let them grab some grain and eat it. If they're walking through your vineyard, they can grab a couple grapes. They can grab fruit off the tree and have a bite. You know, it's like when you're at Kroger and you're in the grape section. It's like, you know, just grab a couple grapes, pop them in your mouth. That's cool. Now, in ancient Israel, you couldn't, like, bring, like, a sickle and start, like, you know, get out the combine and start harvesting. Yeah, I mean, Kroger, you can't, like, start stuffing grape, whole things of grapes in your backpack. They'd be like, ma'am, you can't do that here. But it was a reasonable provision, and so there was nothing wrong with them doing that. And so when the Pharisees show up, they're not upset about what they were doing. Like, you're stealing. Now, they're upset about when they were doing it, which was harvesting grain on the Sabbath, not what they were doing when they were doing it. But does it seem strange to anybody else that here are the disciples, they're walking through a grain field, and all of a sudden, out of nowhere, boom, Pharisees, plural. There's a pack of Pharisees. It's like some role-playing game, you know? So here's the second violation of their rules is Sabbath harvesting. Sabbath harvesting. All right, so, yeah, so... So again, here they are, walking through the field. You can almost imagine the disciples like, did you hear something? The footsteps stop, you know. They walk a little further, they hear, shh, 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 shh. And they're like, what is that? And they're like, popping grain, you know. And then all of a sudden, boom. out of the grain arise the Pharisees. Hello, Jesus. We all happen to be walking through this grain field, and we happen to notice a violation. Sabbath law 7.2403B. I'm sure you're familiar with it. The Mishnah, a collection of Jewish teachings compiled about 200 CE, has extensive rules in their Sabbath tractate. Like this one: a tailor should not go out carrying his needle near nightfall, lest he forget and cross a boundary. Nor a scribe with his pen. Tailors, they weren't even supposed to, if they're going out and it's like getting to be almost Sabbath time, because Sabbath started at sundown and went till the next sundown, they weren't even supposed to bring their needle with them. Because what if they're coming along and they see like something that needs sewed and they're like, they're like, ah! Or a scribe got their pen and they see something that needs copied and they're like, oh my God! They're like, look, not only should you just stay away from all these extra rules we've added on top of, you know, so God makes his command, take a day off. And they're like, man, we need some rules. We need a lot of rules. We can't just have a day off. That's way too easy. That sounds like way too much fun. What does it mean to not work? What does it mean to relax? What is permissible and not permitted at all by law? And so we've got all these rules about sewing and copying things, and you shouldn't even bring something that might tempt you to break one of our rules that we've built around this really simple, nice thing that God gave us, which was vacation day. On the Sabbath, one should not search his clothes for fleas. And so you're like, it's a Sabbath, and you're kind of like, I think I got some fleas. Only 22 more hours. I love the weekend. No reading by the light of a lamp, because I guess you're like, I think it's because you'll strain your eyes to read. And that would be like work. I don't understand this next one. A man with gonorrhea should not eat a meal with a woman with gonorrhea because it leads to transgression. Why do we need this law? Was this a common thing? Like, hey, I noticed you have gonorrhea. I don't know if you realize this. Just too much temptation, I guess. You turn to 7:2, and here's the 39 things that they detail. He who sows, plows, weeps, binds sheaves, threshes, winnows, selects crops, grinds, sifts, kneads, bakes, shears wool, washes it, beats it, dyes it, spins, weaves, makes two loops, weaves two threads, separates two threads, ties, unties, sews two stitches, tears in order to sew two stitches. He who traps it, or slaughters it, flays it, salts it, cures its hide, scrapes it, cuts it up, writes two letters, erases two letters to write two letters, builds, tears down, puts out a fire, kindles a fire, hits with a hammer, and transports an object from one domain to another. And so we're like, it's my day off. I'm supposed to relax. I'm on vacation. I hope I'm doing it right. I don't want to mess up. God will be upset. Leon Morris points out the Pharisees would find in the plucking of the ears a breach of the regulation which forbade reaping. When they rubbed it together to break the outer part off, that was threshing. Throwing away the husks probably was winnowing. And eating showed that they had prepared food on the Sabbath. They're supposed to make the meal ahead of time so you don't have to cook on the Sabbath. Man, four distinct breaches of the Sabbath in one mouthful. And they were angry. He was not following their rules. The Talmud regards reaping and grinding corn no greater in bulk than a dried fig as culpable. So one dried fig's worth of corn. And you know how small a dried fig is, right? Yeah, me either. But I've had Fig Newtons before. Those are not big, okay? And so they're harvesting on the Sabbath. And Jesus replied, haven't you read the scriptures? Remember that part where David, what he did when he and his companions were hungry? This is 1 Samuel 21. Jesus is referring to here. He went into the house of God and he broke the law by eating the sacred loaves of bread that only the priest can eat. David was the anointed of God, one of the greatest figures in the Old Testament. The Messiah was said to be the son of David and would be like David in many ways. And David was on the run from this crazy guy named King Saul who was trying to kill him, who was the king, at least for the time, until God took him down and raised David up as king. And so David's on the run. He shows up at Nob, this town, and he's like, I need food. And the priest is like, I don't have any food. All we got is this special bread that goes in the tabernacle that's supposed to be right there before the Lord. It looks like they had just changed the bread, which would have meant it's on the Sabbath. And so David, he's like, give me that bread. And not just, I need five loaves. I need for all my buddies here. And what happened? He got the bread and he gave some to his buddies. And so here's this holy bread that the law said needed to be in the tabernacle. It's supposed to be for the priests. It was probably a Sabbath too. And David's like, give me the bread, I'm hungry. And the priest's like, sounds good. And he fed him. Total violation of the law, right? And yet what does the Old Testament say about that? Nothing. It affirms it. The priest gave him the bread. David took the bread. This great holy man. And so what is Jesus saying? He's saying, if you're going to condemn me, then you got to condemn David. You got to condemn all his righteous buddies, and you got to condemn that high priest. He's thrusting them on the horns of a dilemma. He's showing them how ridiculous their position is. He's like, wow, your rules are pretty good. They're so good, they make one of the greatest men in the Old Testament out to be a sinner who's in violation of your laws. He says, you can either condemn me and David and all of them, or maybe you guys have taken things way too far with your rules and your rigid legalistic application of them. And you've totally missed the point. Jesus says in Matthew 12, similar or the exact same discussion, he says, didn't Moses command the priests to work on the Sabbath? So your laws also condemn Moses and all the priests that are following the law of Moses. In John 7:23, Jesus says, you guys, didn't you guys circumcise people on the Sabbath? Baby boys, 8-day-old? He says, so you're fine circumcising somebody on the Sabbath, and I made the whole guy well, and you're mad at me. Now he says in Mark 2, he says, people weren't made for the Sabbath. The Sabbath was made for people. That was God's original intention. And Jesus added, and the Son of Man is Lord even over the Sabbath. A bold claim, even bolder than his bridegroom reference. The Son of Man, that's a Messiah title from the Old Testament. And he says, I'm Lord over the Sabbath. Jesus, he's like, whatever, I do what I want with the Sabbath. I'm the one that came up with it. That Old Testament that I wrote that prescribes it, yeah. You scribes who I made are criticizing me for breaking your rule that you made? No, he says, the Son of Man is Lord even over the Sabbath. This is, I mean, imagine a cop pulls you over and he's like, I got you doing 90 miles per hour and a 55 back there. And imagine turning up the cop and being like, I'm sorry, sir, but the promised one, is Lord of the Traffic Laws. And then you just roll your window up. I'm going to change them all anyway soon. You know, that's the point where the Pharisees go from this to this. They just can't believe it. They can't believe what they're seeing. On another Sabbath day, a man with a deformed right hand was in the synagogue while Jesus was teaching. Another Sabbath controversy, another violation of their laws. And the teachers of the religious law and the Pharisees were watching Jesus closely. So they're all over it, man. If he healed the man's hand, they planned to accuse him of working on the Sabbath. Like, man, see that poor disabled man? I hope Jesus heals him so we can get him. Violation number three, Sabbath healing. Now, they did have a category for necessary life-saving medical procedures on the Sabbath. Like if they were going to die before the next day, then you could save a life on the Sabbath, but only if the person was in immediate danger. They allowed midwives to work on the Sabbath too, because if a woman goes into labor, she's not going to wait because it's the Sabbath. But this sort of thing, this would have been not covered by those exceptions. I mean, the guy's been, he's been crippled his whole life. What's one more day? We're going to get him. Think how heartless this is. They're using this poor man as bait. No mercy, no compassion. And they're wondering if Jesus can withhold mercy and compassion as well as they can. Is Jesus really as unloving as them and all their legalistic rules? Heartless. Well, Jesus, he knew their thoughts somehow. And he's going to take this thing head on. Jesus calls to the man with the deformed hand. He says, come on up, right up in front of everybody. Come on up here. Stand. And the man came forward. And so the whole synagogue is like holding their breath here. They're shocked. They don't know what's going to happen. And then Jesus said to his critics, I got a question for you guys. I have a question. Does the law permit good deeds on the Sabbath? Or is it a day for doing evil? Is it a day to save life or to destroy it? And so Jesus is reframing the issue. He's not framing it in terms of, am I following your little law? You can get me on a technicality. Sabbath rule 7.93BQ. He says, should we love people on the Sabbath? Should we have mercy and compassion on this man who's suffered in poverty his whole life? Couldn't work, probably. Is a disgrace to his parents, his family. Should we just treat this guy like bait in your little game that you're playing here? Or do you think we should do good? What do you think? You know, Jesus' framing would be a sin to do nothing. This is why he said in the past to these guys, why don't you go and learn what this means? I desire mercy and compassion, not sacrifices. And he looked around at them one by one. No one answered his question. Imagine this horrified man looking in horror, pleading for any of them to cast a yes vote. Yes, it's okay in this one instance to heal this guy. He knows that his future well-being is hanging in the balance here. And they all just stood there, silent, arms folded, uncompassionate, uncaring, determined to be right until the very end. And he said to the man, hold out your hand. And as the guy held out his hand, it was restored. Jesus didn't really outwardly do any work. Heals the guy. And so here, imagine the joy that should have filled this room. Imagine the amazement people should have seen as they see the love of God and the compassion of God, and as they start to see the true meaning of the Sabbath, a day where we've got time set aside from our busy pursuit of greed to do good. And what do they get instead? The enemies of Jesus were wild with rage, and they began to discuss what to do with him, how to kill him. Oh, so angry that he helped that guy. So angry about how he made us look. It's not about other people. It's about how they look. And Jesus is going to wipe away all of the long lists of rules and regulations that they had come up with, and he's going to redefine things in terms of love. So I just want to conclude by talking about this question right here. Does the Sabbath apply today for Christians? A lot of Christians are confused on this. The answer is no, it doesn't. Romans 14 talks about this. Paul's like, you know, some people, they still think that one day is like more important than another. We know that that's not true. You know, every day, you know, as it says in the Psalms, this is the day that the Lord has made. Let us rejoice and be glad in it. It's not like one day a week is for God and the other 6 days a week are for me. No, my whole life is for God. And Jesus is wiping away these ceremonial distinctions that God had in the Old Testament. Now, a lot of Christians think Sunday is the Sabbath day. No, Saturday was the Sabbath in the Old Testament. The early church, it looks like, at least in some cases, they gathered together on Sunday. But, you know, there's nothing special about Sunday or any other day of the week. Now, I think the principle behind the Sabbath is still pretty good. We're just going to spend our whole lives driving ahead, trying to be as greedy as possible, trying to accomplish as much as possible, make as much money as possible. That's a recipe for disaster. It's a recipe for burnout. We need to build margin into our lives. We need to take time off. And when we take time off, we need to make sure it's actually restful and not the kind of thing that's going to leave us more drained and more reluctant to get back to work. I mean, we were made to work. There's a fulfillment that comes from working hard. But we can't just do that nonstop and keep hitting the adrenaline button. There does need to be a work-rest cycle. And part of what God's trying to do, he's trying to build margin into our lives so we have time for people, so we have time for him. That's why I think it's good to take a portion of every day and spend time with the Lord in his word, talking to him. I think it's good. I recommend people take a longer block of time sometime each week where they have it set aside for rest. And even maybe part of that for deeper study, more extended time with God. This is why we set aside blocks of time several times a week for each other. We're trying to carve out margin in our lives where we can get together as a group or one-on-one. We often will crack the word open, focus on that, and then get into each other's lives. So I think the principle is still good, but different people are going to implement this differently. And Christians get into trouble when they get real rigid about exactly the way to do this. And we start to come up with our own Talmud, our own version of the Sabbath laws that grow up around some of the basic principles of loving God and loving one another. Ultimately, though, the Old Testament Sabbath pointed to a greater rest. It says in Hebrews 4, there still remains a rest for the people of God. And this rest is a rest from our works. It's a rest from my self-effort to struggle to God. And instead, it's resting in the finished work of Christ, as we studied in the book of Hebrews. And, you know, there's different pictures for this kind of rest. You know, like John 15, Jesus says it's like a branch plugged into a vine or a tree. Where that branch, he says, you need to abide in me. You need to plug into me. And you're going to bear much fruit. That branch is not straining away with effort to produce fruit. It's just connecting into the source of life. In Matthew 11, Jesus puts it this way. He says, come to me, all of you who are weary, all of you who carry heavy burdens, and I will give you what? Rest. You feel that way? You feel weary? You feel like you're carrying heavy burdens around? Jesus says, I'm going to give you rest. He says, take my yoke upon you. The yoke was this big wooden thing that went across two oxen. And he said, get that off your back right now. He says, look, link up with me. We're going to go through this life together. Take my yoke upon you. It's not a life where we do nothing, but it's where we do the work of God and where we do the will of God with our lives. We seek, that's our purpose, to honor him. And then he says, let me teach you because I'm humble and I'm gentle in heart, about as far as you could get from these Pharisees. I'm humble, I'm gentle, I know your weaknesses. I know that you don't have it all together, and I want you anyway. And he says, if you'll do that, you will find rest for your souls. One of the greatest promises we get from God, rest for your souls. This is the offer Jesus is making you tonight, to come in to his rest. We really need to learn from you, because you are gentle and humble in heart. We need you to teach us to be like you. But we also need to stop making you out to be somebody you're not. This legalistic God that wants to cancel all fun and make us jump through all these hoops. A God who's disgusted with us. We thank you, Lord, that once you've forgiven us, that we're yours and that you love us and you want to spend time with us, God. I pray that, some of us, Lord, we need to learn how to enjoy a relationship with you, walking with you, how to enjoy your good gifts to us, Lord, how to enjoy your rest. And I pray for those of us here, God, who have not found rest for our souls. I pray that they would come to Christ. I pray they would do that tonight. They wouldn't spend any longer living a life of purposelessness, but that they would live a life for you, in a relationship with you, carrying out the law of love. Amen.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.